welcome to Woodrose Radio and our new show, Magic Mondays, featuring your hosts, Joy and Brian. Join us every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern for a show discussing all things magical. Hello! Welcome to Woodrose Radio again. This is Brian. We have Joy here.
Hey, everybody. Okay, I got to turn it down on my end here because I don't want feedback going through the phone. So just
True.
Enough to hear what I'm saying. All right. So tonight is the inaugural episode of Magic Mondays, and as we've been talking about on Tarot Talk, this is going to be a show about not necessarily all things magical, but the 201 and 301 Wicca that everybody wants, and then when it actually gets written and presented to them, doesn't sell. So maybe if we change it around and put it into a different format, as a blog, a podcast, or something along those lines, it'll do a little bit better. Because, I mean, everybody's heard all the same Wicca and Paganism 101 everything. But the authors really can't go into detail with it because they have to keep presenting the same basic information over and over and over, assuming that the reader is totally ignorant of the subject matter. Now, how this can happen, I have no idea, because, I mean, if you swing a dead cat in a metaphysical bookstore, you're going to hit a 101 book somewhere. And it's
True.
Kind of hard to miss these days. I mean, it's not like this is still the 70s and 80s, where the only beginning books on Wicca and witchcraft were from, like, four people, and then you went into the Golden Bough. These days, there's, you know, tons of stuff that's out there, and everybody has their own interpretation of it. The problem is coming in that there's no continuation of it. I know of about five books that start delving into the more advanced material, but it's assumed that you're supposed to discover all of this for yourself and work it out on your own. And unfortunately for solitary practitioners, it's not really possible all the time. For somebody that's in a coven, yeah, it's quite possible because there's other people there with you and you can talk about it and you can kick ideas back and forth and you can share with other practitioners. And then there's also the extended community around it. Unfortunately, what winds up happening is that you get codified ideas that are stuck at this one group's level. And they never really advance past that because this high priestess says that this is how things should be, and then the people that she's been teaching say that this is how it's supposed to be, and then the people that they teach say this is how it's supposed to be. And so you get this whole community saying the same thing when it's not necessarily so, and they never really look beyond that. So hopefully this podcast is going to address things like that so that we can actually start having a larger discussion on hows and whys rather than just all of us repeating the same thing over and over. So tonight's episode is going to be about your ritual book. I'm not going to call it a Book of Shadows, even though that's what we're talking about, simply due to the fact that Book of Shadows is a specific term to Wicca. I would imagine that there are all other practitioners out there in Asatru, I know in Druidism, in various other fields who also have something similar. So we're just going to label it generically as your ritual book. And this is, you know, supposed to be a book that you go in and you put all of your ideas and your rituals down in, and it's a place to keep them together so that when you're having your ritual, you can put it up on the big lectern and, you know, have the candles stuck to the top of it so that you can see it and turn the page, and it's all in calligraphy and everything. You know, like you see some out of some medieval painting or something.
Well, I mean, the thing that I've noticed a lot on YouTube is that everyone's got a variation on the theme, but it almost becomes kind of who can do the best version of the very same thing that their neighbor's doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's like I'm expressing myself as an individual by doing this same kind of... Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's like hundreds of how-to books or videos on YouTube that talk about how to create the charmed style Book of Shadows or what have you. And it's like, well, you know, that's great if you're, you know, a fan of Charmed. I mm-hmm. used to be. I mean, I loved it. But if you're trying to incorporate like TV memorabilia into your spiritual practice, I mean, there comes a point where, you know, you're just getting a little bit excessive in doing so, because it becomes a game or a show for how creative you can be in, you know, trying to create this art piece that you can't read in the dark of candlelight, you know.
And that's the thing, like, isn't it? It's the practicality that seems to be lacking in everything. I mean, if you're in an indoor situation, everything is well lit, and you've got electric lights burning all over the place, and, you know, the super fancy calligraphy like you see in the Book of Kells is great, and it looks fantastic, and it certainly does bring a mystical, magical air to it. But if you're outside in a circle at night, and it's midnight out, and you've got maybe 3 dozen candles around, none of them shining right on the book, and you're sitting on the ground, and the wind is blowing, and so the candlelight is flickering, that thing becomes useless because you can't read it at that point. So what you really have to start with, I mean, I think the really basic starting point with any ritual book is how it's going to be used. Okay, if you're going to be using it as a way of filing your rituals, then, yeah, go wild, do whatever you want. But if you're going to be using it in practical matters, in a standardized way, outside with the wind blowing, during rain, whatever, or inside, then you actually can do a little bit, you need to think about doing it differently. But let's step back and start actually thinking about from the beginning. Here you are, a new practitioner of whatever form that you're deciding to practice, be it religion or be it Wicca, be it Christianity, whatever. And you want to make a book where you can put your own thoughts in there, okay? That's great. That would be your metaphysical journal, okay? And that is separate, in my opinion, from the ritual book. Because if you think about back when you were in church as a Christian, I don't know about any of the listeners out there, but I was raised Christian. We had the book of rituals, and we had the book of thoughts. And it was pretty much you took the two of them together, but one had the liturgy in it. You bow here, you say this, you kneel here, you pray this, you stand up, you sing this, you sit down, you listen, and the actual stage directions for the ritual. And then the other one was the commentaries on not only the ritual but the religion itself, what you should be feeling, what you should be bringing to it, what practices you should have, the theory behind the religion, okay? And that I know of, just about every single religious and magical group out there has this. I mean, you have the in Judaism, you have the Talmud and you have the Torah. The Torah is the ritual.
Yeah.
The Talmud is the law and the commentaries. In Catholicism, you've got the prayer book and you've got the Bible. And in, you know, Wicca, you've got the Book of Shadows, and then you've got your Book of Mirrors, which is the journal. So you really got to figure out what this is going to be. Is it going to be the ritual book, or is it going to be the journal? You
yeah,
can,
definitely.
If you want, combine both of them into one. I've seen it successfully done. The problem is that you can't ever find anything you want when you want it.
Yeah, and I think, too, that it's kind of, it's almost sort of a beginner kind of thing where, you know, you've just started into a new path. You're not entirely certain that, you know, this is the one you want to walk the rest of your life kind of thing. So, you know, you don't want to go crazy and splurge on, you know, getting several different books for different purposes. And I mean, a lot of 101 authors tend to advise against, you know, collecting random books that, you know, ultimately lose their meaning because you're trying to scatter everything while you're learning.
Yeah, and that first year is really important for making decisions like this. You want to know what my first Book of Shadows was? It was an old black and white marbleized composition notebook, 150 pages. When you held it in one direction, it was all the rituals, and then you flipped it over, and there was all of the journaling that I did. And it worked beautifully. I had one book. I wrote on one side of the page, but every page was used, front and back. So I didn't have to go out and spend $50 on a lockable journal. This was just, this was a literally a $1.50 or a dollar at a dollar store, and they were trying to get rid of them. They were praying for us to take them. And
yeah.
I went out and bought like five of them. And I still have that one, you know, 20 years later, and we've still got it, and I still go back to it occasionally.
The old days when a dollar store actually sold stuff for a dollar.
Yeah. Well, they still have a few of them, but it's not stuff that you'd actually want to buy for a dollar.
That's pretty much it. Like, food sources, you kind of go, where'd they get this for a dollar?
Yeah. How long has it been sitting on the shelves? Oh, look, Twinkies. These are from the 1920s. Still good.
They're indestructible. You can still eat them. A decade or 20 from now. I'm sure the next millennium will still have fresh Twinkies from this decade.
Oh, I'm sure. Speaking of dollar stores, a great place to go and get a lot of your altar dressing, a lot of the things that you need for starting out. I mean, when you can get 1,000 tea lights for a buck or 2 dozen candles for a dollar.
That's very true.
You know, this is really a good thing. No, because you can get emergency candles. It doesn't have to be the 2-foot-long tapers.
Yeah, for sure.
But the little emergency candles that are only about 6 inches long, you can get a box of a dozen for a dollar.
And you can get, like, a bunch of candle holders for cheap. And, I mean, it's a very practical thing when you're starting out to start using dollar stores as your first sort of supply depot.
Yeah.
Because especially when, I don't know about what it's like down there, but up here, in Canada, by the way, folks, I'm Canadian, Joy is American. You know,
yeah, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. He's, I think, out above Seattle someplace.
Victoria, British Columbia, actually. Beautiful city.
Oh, so, wait a second, British Columbia? No, I'm thinking Prince Edward Island again. Never mind.
It's Vancouver
Geography
Island.
Is not my
far
strong
bigger
suit.
Island. That's okay. But, yeah, I mean, up here, come, say, Samhain or, you know, Yule, you've got, like, sort of the specific holiday-oriented stock of incenses and candle colors and decorations that come out. And, you know, if you're looking for a skull, you know, for your Samhain altar, you wait around long enough, then you're going to have like purple glitter skulls or, you know, like white foam skulls painted gray kind of thing. You know, and it's a good cheap way to decorate, especially if you're, you know, just trying yourself, you know, trying out the spiritual path you've decided to walk.
Yeah, it's like we said, you know, dollar stores are the lifesaver of a lot of beginning Wiccans. Not only do they have blank books cheaply available, they got candles, they've got candle holders, they have things that can be easily converted into altar dressings. You know, the table cover for an end table becomes a wonderful altar drape. They have, you know, dishes, just big plastic or ceramic dishes that are flat that you can paint a pentacle on. You know, and they've, you know, a lot of them have craft-like stuff. You can also find things like some of the statues. A mother and child statue that was popular with mom holding her child can be a beautiful goddess figurine, you know, because that's, you know, pretty much perfect for that. And this, dollar stores are wonderful for just starting out. You don't have to keep them. You can get rid of them and replace them with other things.
And, yeah, that's the thing, too. I mean, when you walk into a dollar store, a lot of people have a certain idea programmed in their head of what they're going to find or how it can be used. And I think one of the big exercises when you walk into a dollar store is to sort of teach yourself to see how something can be used in a different way than it's being marketed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got like an array of, say, wooden spoons or, you know, kitchen knives or something hanging up, you know, on the racks. You've got an athame or a wand right there. You know, it doesn't have to be fancy. And if you are, you know, a kid, for instance, starting out on a pagan path in a really conservative household,
mm-hmm.
Buying these innocuous items can really help you, you know, learn to use the tools without calling too much attention to yourself, aside from, you know, explaining why you have a wooden spoon in your drawer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially when you can, you know, take a sharp knife and carve a couple of symbols into it, you know, unobtrusively. I mean, because let's face it, back during the Inquisition and previous to this, they didn't have plaster of Paris, a goddess figurines that they could go out to the shop and pick up. They had to make their own. So they made things that were from their household. You know, the athame that they're using as their sacred ritual knife now probably helped butcher out a chicken earlier that evening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and even when you're talking about some of the older laws with Gardner and Ordains, it says, you know, make your ritual tools out of things that are easily destroyed because the witch hunters will come and get you if they find them. You know, make your pentacle from wax so you can toss it into the fire and melt it down and there's no evidence. You know, it's bullshit, but, you know, it's still, you know,
but I think
advice.
That was part of the allure for me, especially when I was starting out, because, you know, at 9 and 10 years old, I was reading about the Salem witch trials, and, you know, that's how I got my start in witchcraft and Wicca. And part of the allure of it was, you know, that looming threat of the boogeyman who's going to, like, punish me as a witch.
They're going to come running in just any minute, and your little closet isn't going to be able to save you, and they're going to find your witch's nipple. And
exactly. Oh, yeah, if you're going to read a book about witchcraft and you want to really just have your mind blown, read the Malleus Maleficarum.
Oh, my God.
That is some crazy shit.
I know of it. I've read enough of it to know that it's just one of those things
it
that...
It is so nuts. It's horrible.
Oh, my God. Somebody put a seal on butter. Okay, never mind. Anyway,
yeah.
Getting back to the ritual books. Okay. Start simply. First off, start with a goal of what you want it to be, okay? Then start figuring out the easiest, simplest way of starting this just in case you don't want to keep going with it, because you're not going to go out and buy a $500 handmade parchment and vellum ritual book with a hand-carved cover, you know, that you, for something that you're going to drop in a week. Or, you know, you actually might, but it's going to be a lot of money that's wasted, and I'm sure the artisan will be very grateful to supply it to you. But there's most people aren't going to do that. So a basic journal, a basic diary type thing, a spiral notebook. My daughter started her book of rituals in a spiral notebook, and you go from there. You start out by writing it out. You understand what's going on, and then you need to organize it, okay? This is where some witches really shine, and there are a lot of fluffy pagan babies that really fall down with this one, in that they make it for looks but not for practical use. Here's an example of it. Okay, you have a circle coming up that you're going to be doing the high priestess thing for. And you're going to be doing the raising the temple, the casting the circle, the invitation of the gods, the invitation for the four quarters. You're going to do the full moon ritual. You're going to do the Samhain Sabbat. You're also going to do three healings, and then you're going to do the thanks, the cakes and ale, and then the dismissing the circle. Then you go to your ritual.
And you're going
book.
To be there for 7 hours.
Yeah,
crap.
It's possible. It could be. But here's the thing. If you go to your ritual book, and let's say the dismissing the circle was the first thing you learned, and that's on page 5. And then the Samhain Sabbat is on page 200. And then you're flipping through your ritual book for 5 minutes, and you finally come to the raising the temple, and that's on page 120. Okay, that's not an organized thing. You're having to flip back and forth in the middle of ritual. It's breaking your concentration. It's frustrating you, and it's distracting from the mood you're trying to create. So what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to figure out how you want to organize this. Do you want to put it in a A, B, C, D order as you learned it? Do you want to put it in order where it makes sense as to how it appeared in the book that you copied these from? Because believe it or not, very few people write their own rituals. Most crib rituals from other people. I mean, in some of these pagan paths, it's required that you say the same ritual every single time, no matter if you're just starting the pathway or if you've got a book that's 200 years old. It's going to be the exact same ritual. So you have to figure out how these are going to go together. Do you put the raising the temple and the closing the temple together? Do you put the raising the temple in the beginning of the book, all the rituals that you might be doing next, and then the closing the temple at the back of the book? How do you want to organize it? And then how do you want to index it? Okay? One of my first books that I had was I put those page tabs on the edge so that I knew which section I could turn to find what I was looking for. I had the beginning ceremonies, the things that you would do in the front of the ceremony, the welcoming, the opening the temple, the bringing the people in, the consecrations, the inviting the gods, the inviting, invoking the watchtowers. Those were in the front of the book, and then I had all the rituals in the middle, and then all the magic just after them. Then I had the closing the temple at the end of that. But then I reorganized it so that it was the same way as was in the book that I was taking this from, the Sayax Wiccan book written by Buckland called The Tree. And that, while I understood how it was laid out and why it was laid out like that, it didn't flow right because I was flipping from one side to the other as I was doing the rituals. So I reorganized it, okay? And that brings us to the next point. A bound-together blank-page book for you to use when you're starting out is a wonderful thing, okay? However, at some point, you're going to want to be able to move the pages around. This is when the three-ring binder becomes a precious thing. Most witches, most pagans, most people that have ritual books that I know of have in their inventory someplace a three-ring binder of rituals. And they can move those rituals around. They have them in page protectors. Sometimes they're index tabbed. Sometimes they have dividers. But they have them so that you can pull out all the rituals that you're expecting to perform that night and put them in the front of the book in order that you need to use them in. So for the example of our seven-hour ritual that I just used, the raising the temple would be first. The invocation of the gods would be next. The watchtowers would be next. Then the full moon rite. Then the Sabbath rite. Then the healings that you're going to do. Okay? But next time, in the very front, it's going to still be the raising, the gods, the watchtowers. But then you're going to be having the Espit rite, the regular meeting. And then you might be having the Ostara rite next. But that saves you from flipping back and forth between the book and getting frustrated and trying to find what you're looking for and not seeing it. Especially, once again, when you're outside in a circle at night with nothing but candlelight.
Well, yeah, and especially if you're participating in a group situation. I mean, having the pages of different rituals in page protectors allows you the freedom to take out the pages you need for that ritual and to copy them for the people that are participating so that everyone's on the same page, figuratively and literally. You know, so that, you know, you're not, like, trying to figure out what needs to happen because you've got a bunch of new people who've never been to a ritual before and are participating because your group just happens to feel that that's completely reasonable. It allows them to glance at the page and understand their part and where it sits in the ritual. So there's no confusion about it.
Right. And with being able to rearrange stuff like that, as you get indexes and as you get more insights into the different rituals and you're adding commentary to it, you don't have to flip to the end of the written out pages or, you know, crib this tiny little note into the margins on the actual ritual that you have. Instead of having, you know, pages and pages and pages of herbalism notes and then one tiny note on how the Day of the Dead celebrations in Mexico relate to Samhain, you know, you can actually add the material to the ritual where it's relevant instead of, you know, sticking a comment someplace and having to find it like that. And this is one of the things that I think, you know, the modern world is really, really good on and really successful in, is that we don't have to have microscopic writing like you see in, oh, I don't know, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, where you have a whole bunch of stuff that's written that's relevant to what you're doing on other pages. I mean, you hear about the medieval grimoires, and you read about, I mean, you can pick up a copy of the Key of Solomon someplace, and there will be times when you're reading through the text, and then there'll come a point that relates to something that you've already read, where it's out of context because this was discovered later. So, you know, with the modern world at least, now you've got the ability to add things where it's supposed to go. Okay, all you need is a printer and a computer.
And actually, you've reminded me of something that I think is worth addressing. In most magical traditions, there are certain alphabets that are, you know, traditional or
God.
Okay, let's just admit it, fun to use. But you know, if you read some of the older stuff, I can't think of any really good examples offhand, but there are books that, you know, from like the 80s and earlier that talk about how it was customary to learn, say, Theban script or
Passing the River or Angelic. That would be Gardner and Buckland, mostly.
Yeah, exactly. It's fun to learn these alphabets, but if you can't read that by candlelight, you know, it's not going to be really practical for you to have it in your, you know, in your ritual book.
Let's step back just a second and look at this. One thing that I'm a huge advocate of is understanding that your book of rituals, your book of shadows, your magical tome, your grimoire, whatever in the hell you want to call it, is not one book. It is an entire reference library. I have a book of shadows that encompasses 20 milk crates at this point, and about 1 gig of space on my website. Okay? This is not
And you tell
one
this is a witch
thing.
From before the internet.
Yes. You know, because any information that you get, if you were an engineer and you did rocket science, you would not have one book of formulas and your slide rule. Those would not be the only tools that you used, and those would not be the only things that you would look at when you were doing your craft. Wicca and paganism is the exact same way. You don't have just your Book of Shadows, and you don't just have your Athame. You have an entire reference library, and that collectively is your ritual book, your Book of Shadows. So it is perfectly acceptable to have a pretty book that is sitting on your altar that people can leaf through and see this ritual written out in this beautiful, illuminated, calligraphied script that you're never going to use in a practical situation.
Very true.
Very nice to have a very large, thick, three-ring binder that has 20-point type, all bold-faced, with the stage directions of move here and do this in red that you can read on a windy night with a sliver of moonlight and one candle illuminating the page. Mm-hmm. There's also the perfectly acceptable to also have a ritual book that you have sat down and handwritten by yourself, copying it from your teacher, and have that sitting on your shelf too. Okay? So you're going to have multiple books. You're going to have multiple ritual books. It's going to depend on how you use them. Okay.
Well,
the handwritten one is there because it's always good to know.
It's a memory aid, actually. If you're sitting and slowly handwriting.
It's not just that. The handwriting is important in that. You have to read the material that you're copying from in order to actually sit down and write it out. Okay, you have to see it right there in front of you. This is a way of the teacher guaranteeing that you read it at least once.
That's true.
Because anybody can cut and paste off of a website, stick it in a document, and never look at it again.
That's so true. Holy crap.
But when you actually sit down and handwrite it out in your own journal, the teacher is guaranteeing that you have read through the material at least one time in the process of copying. Now, you're probably going to have to copy it 3 or 4 times because the first time you copy it, the 12-year-old who's actually starting to get into it and they're writing it out and they're just, whatever, okay, yes, priestess moves over here, she says this. She kisses this person, you know, and then they look at it 3 years later and they're like, what the hell did I write there? That's chicken scratch. So they're going to have to copy it again.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, part of having a quote, Book of Shadows, that encompasses multiple volumes is that there's also situations where you may find a particular poem or some quote from some literature that will fit perfectly into the ritual that you're going to be doing. And mm-hmm. being able to, like, run to that volume, say the complete works of William Shakespeare, if you happen to like Act One or Act One, that's the, you know, double toil and trouble one that everyone loves.
Out of the Scottish play.
Yes. The Scottish play.
By the prickling, you know, like, of my thumb, something wicked this way comes.
If you guys want a really good rendition of that intro scene, get Omnia's Witch's Brew. Fantastic little, you know, thing. They've turned it into a song, and it's just a few lines from the witch's theme. But yeah, I mean, like, there may be, say, a William Blake poem that totally suits your ritual, and, you know, being able to get hold of that in a complete verse of William Blake or whatever, and be able to use that in your ritual will greatly enhance your experience, as opposed to cutting and pasting some full elaborate ritual that, you know, you found on some website somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And then there's always the thing that you're going to have one book someplace that is yours. What I mean by that is that all of the other grimoires, all the other ritual books that you're going to have are actually going to be somebody else's. Now, you may have assembled it, you may have put it together, you may have written it out, you may have done all the calligraphy work or whatever, but the rituals contained in them are somebody else's creation. At some point, you're going to sit down and you're going to go, okay, saying this, that, and the other means absolutely nothing to me. I feel nothing during the ritual, and I want to make this meaningful to me. And you're going to write out your own ritual with your own symbolism and your own thoughts and your own feelings and something that has meaning to you. And that, from then on, is going to be your ritual book, because it will be yours in more senses than one. Because the act of creating something like that, writing it out and making it so that it's meaningful to you, creates it. It's an act of creation. It's the one thing that humans can do that no other race can do, is create. Okay, it's the power that the gods gave us, not only in being able to choose our own destinies without interference, but we can make things from nothing. Okay, in all my work and all my time on the astral plane with others, they can modify, they can change, they can add to, they can put another spin on everything, but only humanity has the ability to go, okay, I've just dreamed a dream, and poof, here it is. This idea came out of nowhere. Okay? So that act of creation makes it yours. It makes it your living work. And you will be able to go out and share that with others. And if it's meaningful to them, fantastic. That'll be great. But the only person that it really has to be meaningful to is you. Okay? But you're not going to get rid of your other books of shadows. They're still going to be there. They're still going to be good reference works. They're still going to give you an outline of how it should be structured and what you should do. Okay? Personally, and I'm going to be hung as a heretic here, I know, the rituals straight out of the tree that Buckland came up with for Sayax Wicca, I find kind of cold. Mary and I, when we do our rituals here, we basically improv the whole thing because we know the structure we want. There's the opening. There's the invocation of the gods and beings that are going to be there. There's the actual working magic ritual celebration part. There's the the giving thanks, the Thanksgiving, the cakes and ale at towards the end to ground us out with all of this energy that we've been using. And then there's the thanking of those entities and the dismissing and the dissipation of the circle and all the energies we raised. That is the basic framework for any ritual night that you want to have, okay? And once you know that, once you know what elements to put in there, and once you understand what is sacred to you, what is meaningful to you, you don't need the ritual book anymore. You don't need the rote, go here, stand here, do this, say this, poke this thing, grab this god out of the sky and slam them, body slam them to the earth. you actually understand what you're doing, and you can improv the entire ritual. It's one of the things that I think is kind of funny with the crash kits and the emergency and the portable altars and stuff, because here's this little packet of everything you need to do a circle on the go in case you have to help somebody. And you actually need none of it because you can improvise everything of it out of your own mind. But anyhow, okay, back to ritual books. So from then on, that book that you created with your own rituals is going to be your ritual book, and you're going to want to be able to move it around and change things and modify things. And my particular advice is that this one is going to be probably written primarily on the computer. Computers are a godsend. I'm so grateful to Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs for this one thing. And that's the computer. That's the personal computer. Okay. So I guess I should be even more grateful to the great god Tesla for creating the AND gate, which makes computers possible. So, you know. No, it's serious. I mean, think about it. What, 20 years ago, I was talking to somebody on the phone at my job. 20 years ago, if somebody wanted to say, okay, we've got a meeting at X time, and tell 500 people to be there, they would have to sit down, they'd have to hand write out a note, they would have to give it to their secretary would have to type it up. They would give it back to their boss would look over it, correct any typos, give it back to the secretary would retype it up, fixing those typos. She would take it back into the boss would look over it again and then sign it. Then she would take it down to the copy machine, run off 500 copies, and then stick them in her outbox. The mail guy would come by, he would pick up those 500 copies, and he would take it down to the mail room where four other people would sort it out into departments. Then the mail guys for those departments would walk them up to that department and physically hand out pieces of paper saying that here's this meeting. Then each one of those guys would have to write up their own acceptance of that meeting, give it to their secretary, the secretary would send it back, they'd send it back to the secretary would bring it back, they'd sign it, they'd put it in their outbox, they'd take it down to the mailroom would assemble it, would put it all together, and 2 days later you might be able to have the meeting that you wanted to have right now, okay? With the loss of 1,000 sheets of paper or more. But sure. Now, a boss wants to have a meeting, tap, 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 send, and 500 copies of this email show up in the various people's inboxes seconds after he's finished having the decision to make it. They send back their acceptances, and a half an hour later, they're having their meeting.
That's very true. I mean, 20 years ago, even sending an email was a big waste of time because you'd have to go through that dial-up nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
You sound hollow.
Which is why businesses stayed with memos for all the time and the inner office mailings and everything. So, yes, just the ability to be able to manipulate data quickly and accurately and typos. I mean, thank God for whoever developed spell checkers, because I know I can't spell for crap, and I write for a living. And I'm writing away, and I'll have red wavy lines under everything. Can you imagine typing that up on a Selectric typewriter and having all those typos and setting it aside and writing some more and setting it aside, and then having to go back and reread everything, edit all of it and proofread it, and then type it all again.
It's true. Oh, yes. Typing on typewriters. Not a fun way to make mistakes.
So, yeah, just in the ability to manipulate the data and change it and spell check it and proofread it, and then, you know, and that's even forgetting the formatting. I mean, when we first got into Wicca and paganism, we found a resource on AOL called The Writers of the Crystal Wind Book of Shadows. It was a 20-volume work that was about as scattered as you can possibly get. But apparently this one group got their Book of Shadows, and this was their Book of Shadows. They turned it into a text digital format and sent it out to everybody. Now, you want to talk about a scattered piece of crud? This thing had the Lammas Sabbat. Then next it would have commentary on the Military People's Network Remembrance Rite. Then it would have the Mike Nichols article on Samhain in it. Then it would have 12 different rituals on various things, blessings for people. Then it would have something in memoriam for all of the victims of the Inquisition. Then it would have, and you couldn't find anything in this. They had one file that was 85 pages long that was just the table of contents. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
It was incredible. And Mary and I sat down one day. She had to go into work for some reason. And we decided that we were going to format this so that you could find the stuff. And we didn't even start changing where everything appeared in the index, but we started just formatting things so that the rituals were consistent. If somebody was saying a line, we bolded their name and indented it, and then they had what they were saying. If they were moving from point A to point B and doing something, we put it in italics. And we called this the ritual format, the ritual formatting. And we did this for every ritual that we found. Commentaries that were part of the ritual that were secondary to it, we put several paragraph returns in there and put a wavy line in between them to separate it out from the actual ritual. But that made the actually being able to perform the rituals so much easier, because you could actually have a visual reference on, okay, the priest is saying at this point, yada, 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 yada. Then the priest picks up the athame and walks over here. So instead of getting a situation like in Little Orphan, like in Annie, the musical play, where you're reading through and they start reading the stage directions as well as, you know, what they're reading, because there's a scene in Annie where Daddy Warbucks is on the radio and he's talking about, if you see my daughter, find here and go and do this, turn page. And he turns the page, and now we do this and turn page. And that would happen a lot with older rituals, because you couldn't distinguish the speaking parts from the moving parts. Well, once we started formatting it, it made it a lot easier to do these, and it made it a lot easier to see it. And then you also didn't keep going into the commentaries at the end of the ritual. You saw that, okay, this is different from the rest of it. And it added a whole bunch to it. Well, somebody else actually finished the project out, and that's up on the Internet database at this point. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it's actually organized so that it's alphabetical at this point, and you can find things easily and stuff that is supposed
nice.
To be together, like the rituals and articles on the different seasonal things are together. And as far as I know, the people that assembled the Book of Shadows at this point are embarrassed and don't want them out there anymore. Because it's, you know, all copywritten work, and they spent multiple years putting it together. And, you know, apparently it's been shared so much that everybody thinks it's free material when it's not. So, okay, anyway, ritual books. Where are we at? The manipulation of the data and the formatting and everything. You know, if for no other reason, computers are fantastic about that. Because can you imagine having to typewrite all that out just to add the bold to what somebody's saying and the italics to what somebody's doing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember even in the early to mid-90s, there were files available from, you know, the bulletin board systems that, you know, people had tried to do that sort of thing with.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it being very weird. Like, even some of the really interesting sounding rituals, you know, were completely disorganized in that way, you know, and then there was, like, the innumerable books of shadows that, you know, were just basically mishmashes that had barely been, you know, even slightly tweaked to make them, like, you know, understandable. And I think one of the benefits, too, of using a computer for your Book of Shadows, or, you know, at least as some way to organize it, is that you can use different programs to create, you know, spreadsheets, or, you know, Windows computers have, MS Office has something called
Excel. Crap.
Well, that one, too, but that's for spreadsheets.
You're talking about There's Access, like, which is the database?
I think so. I'm trying to remember what it's called because I don't use it that often. And it's this really cool thing where you can create a page within a book that is basically just like a way to organize your information.
Right.
And
sorry, I'm the subject matter expert for Office at work. So what you're talking about is probably the table of contents feature that Word has, where you have it goes through and it looks for specific formatting. Everything that is, you know, 24-point bold and labeled as heading 1, it will go through and find and put into an index at the very beginning of the page as a table of contents. And
nice.
You click on it, it takes you right to that page. And it's pretty cool. And it's great for digital manipulation of the information. It falls down a little bit when you get to printing it out and taking it to a ritual. Because, God help me, I haven't seen this yet, but I know it's coming one day. Some high priestess shows up with her iPad and does the entire ritual from that.
I hope
probably
that never
happened,
come.
But, you know... Talk about ruining your night vision outside when it's windy.
What a weird atmosphere to do a ritual in. It seems very unnatural.
Mm.
I don't know. It's probably just me being anal, but it's a thing with me. Like, if you're going to do a ritual, part of the mood that you're setting has to be devoid of, like, high tech that, you know, distracts.
There you have there's a real huge difference amongst a lot of witches. Yeah, doing a physical ritual with people in the room right there, if you're trying to do a medieval feeling for it, yeah, that's going to really detract from it. If you're trying to do a lodge-type thing, like the Masons would, that would be another detraction. But if you're doing a cyber coven, then that would not be out of place at all. And I know, I know a priestess that her only coven is online. And the participants don't live anywhere near each other. They're from all over the world. And they organize their own... Lisa McSherry is her name. And she's written books on this. And they do online rituals, you know. Now, my thing would be is how do the actual mechanics of it work? Because, you know, to make sure that you don't miss anything during the ritual, it's usually good to have some kind of outline with you. Some of the rituals that I've done, I use tiny cue cards, just little 3x5 index cards that were sitting on the table and reminded me about what I wanted to hit, the points I wanted to hit during this part of the ceremony. And it had, if something had to be said word for word, you know, I printed it out onto that onto that index card, and you know, I would look at it and read it straight off of there to make sure that I got it right. Like our Druidic order had a very specific opening ritual. I call upon Menon and McLear, guardian of this world and the other world realms. Open the I, the Ulma, ask you to open the gateway to the other worlds. And this was a ceremony that stated precedence for our group. It would identify the person saying it as a member of this group, and he would know, okay, this is this group, and we had to say it by rote every single time, okay? I'm not good enough to remember it. It's been years since I had to say it. But I would print it out onto the 3x5 cards during a ritual to make sure that I said it the same way every time. And that was, you know, very, very handy for me. Now, doing an online ritual, when you've got people that are scattered all over the world on all six continents, because somehow I don't think she had any practitioners down in Antarctica, you're talking about... The person that's doing the chat in IRC, I would assume, who is running the ritual, having something similar on another page that they're having to, you know, flip back and forth to, or having a second monitor that the ritual script is up on, and, you know, having to copy and paste and copy and paste and copy and paste and copy and paste. And I just think that would get wearing. But, you know, that's me. So that's, you know, the format thing that I would be going, I don't know about it.
Yeah, I don't know that a cyber ritual would work for me either. Because for that exact reason, I mean, copy-pasting doesn't feel quite as interactive as, you know, having a speaking part or, you know, moving around the circle and, you know, lighting candles or you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think
okay.
You know, to each his own kind of thing.
Yeah. And that brings us into a good segue with tonight's topic of the ritual books. There's a lot of tech-savvy people out there that I know you guys have heard this, have their Disc of Shadows. It started out as a joke back when the bulletin boards were still going, that you had your ritual book written up in text format on a 3.5 inch floppy, or 5 1/4 floppy, depending upon how old it was. And you had a couple of copies of this, and that was your Disc of Shadows, and you blessed it, and you know, you did the labels and drew pictures on it and stuff like that. These days, you're lucky to get one ritual to one of those discs if you still use them. More likely, what you've got is a hard drive of shadows.
Oh, yeah, undoubtedly. Cause, I mean, just some of the basic files nowadays, like each of those 3.5s was like 1 meg.
1.44 megabytes. With the double disk, double side, double density, the single density was only 720K.
Yes, and I mean, just trying to put anything on those nowadays would be insane because, I mean, even a camera phone has, you know, huge files compared to anything that was being passed around in those days.
Oh, God, yes. Hell, a shortcut, one of the shortcuts on your desktop is 1K, 1 kilobyte. So you're talking about something that would take up 1/1000th of the hard of the disk that you were using, just to have something that you would click on to take you someplace else for the information.
True. Yeah, technology has vastly improved, and in that sense, it's a really useful thing for someone who wants to get into, you know, a spiritual path where they want to use a floppy disk or a hard drive for their, you know, rituals.
Well, the good thing about I've actually used floppy disks in rituals for spells. Because what you wind up doing is, in order to access whatever is on the disk, the computer has to read the entire disk, okay? So if you put a null file in there that is hidden, is not going to be opened, that has a spell written out in it, in, say, Fortran, which is a programming language, but it's not compiled so that it's a program. It's just a file. It has all this information in it. Every time you put that disk into the drive, that file will get read. Okay? And magically speaking, if it's read, then it's executed. You're talking about something like a prayer wheel. The Buddhists have the rattles that they spin, and every rotation is a repetition of the prayer that's attached in that prayer wheel, okay? This is essentially the same thing. It's just on a disk.
Huh.
Every time it's actually read, it's executed. So, you know, you do that 600 times when it's trying to access this text file that's on there, you know, and you've got 600 executions of that spell.
Especially handy if you're trying to win the lottery.
Well, can be. There's far too many people that are trying to do that to for that magic to work. Believe me,
that's
very true. Would be rich right now if it actually did work. Anyway, so now we have not only the physical library that you can look at and take down the books and open up and read, but then you've got the digital library as well, and these encompass not only your the files that you've made and that you've written up and that you've formatted for yourself that you print out to put into the notebook so that you have it to go out to the field and put on the altar. But you also have the digital e-books, copies of your references, so that when you're at work, let's say, for example, and you realize that your sister is having gallbladder surgery today and you didn't do anything about it, you actually have your reference with you so that you can open it up, look at whatever the ritual is, type it up in Word really quickly, and then sit there for a couple of minutes and meditate on that and, you know, cast the spell while you're in your cubicle, you know. And nobody's going to think anything about that. You know, that happens every single day, multiple times a day. I do it a lot while I'm at work. So, you know, you've got that too. So you've got your e-library, you've got your personal ritual books, and then you've got your physical library as well. Okay, and then we get to the internet and the websites that you go to, because that's part of your reference works too. And if you've got a personal website with all of your stuff on it, that's another part of it. So what you're really talking about is not just a few dozen books that you have in a special case in your bedroom along with a couple of notebooks. You're talking about terabytes of information that are in your personal ritual book of shadows, the virtual book. And all of that's part of it. But we're getting a little bit off topic. Maybe, I don't know, how long have we been going?
An hour.
We've been going an hour and 12 minutes. So, okay, why don't we take a short break and we'll come back and talk about actually making books of shadows and materials and things like that?
Okay. Let me see if I have anything I can play.
I put Brian on the spot, everybody. I caught him flat-footed.
Well, see, here was my mistake, was that I took all the music off because I was trying to find some new stuff to put on there. So I've got, like, sound effects that are basically, like, fillers.
Okay, well, never mind.
I have a
2.5-minute
meditational soundscape.
Okay, since there's no music up on the things that we can play, let's just move on to the next part of it. One of the things that a lot of people want to do is when they actually do get into, figure out that this is the path that they want to go on for the rest of their life, they actually want to take the beginner's books that they started out with and they hand wrote into the diaries and stuff and compile them into something nice, an heirloom piece for the generations. I actually thought about this a while back and talked to somebody about it. The best of all worlds I can think of, aside from just compiling the virtual Disc of Shadows, was to come up with a scrapbook type thing. Now, I know that there are a lot of people out there into scrapbooking, so you're going to know what I'm talking about when I mention this. But basically what you do is you make the two covers, and then you make a whole bunch of pages to go inside those covers. And they all come apart. They all separate because they're held together by one pin that goes through not only the covers but all the pages as well. And when you start thinking about doing something like this, it's really good to figure out what the final form you want it to look like is, because you can do all kinds of creative design work on the covers, and then if you've got, you know, printed out pages in between them, it looks nice, but it still may not be what you want it to look like. And this is where you can get really, you know, creative with everything and make the parchment pages and super illustrative, illuminated calligraphy and everything. And this is where you can, you know, make the showpiece.
Yeah, and you can also incorporate, like, pressed flowers or herbs or what have you into that, you know.
And
give yourself
people...
that. Go ahead.
And some people, yeah, and some people want to do that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you,
no
Brian.
Worries.
What they can do is if you've got stuff that you have to keep around for a specific spell, like in some cases, here's a good example. One of the wedding rituals that I read said that when the people get married, there's a ribbon that's tied around their wrists. And then at the end of the ceremony, that ribbon is taken and cut into 6 pieces and given to 6 other people. And if they want to get divorced or hand-parted at that point, they have to go and justify to all 6 people who have those pieces why they're doing this and get that piece of the ribbon back from them. So if you
that's
have something
actually
like
pretty
that,
cool.
It is pretty cool, isn't it? Because then they have to, you know, explain together why they don't want to be in this ritual, or in this marriage with this other person to 6 people that they have no clue who they are initially. Okay? I mean, they may know them in a social manner. The witnesses will be written down in the ceremony. But something like that, you know, You put it in your Book of Shadows, you wax it down, and you know right where it's at. It's significant in the book itself so that it's there. You can write down your impressions of the ceremony. You can, you know, anything that is of significance from that. You know, like I know a lot of girls when they go out on their first date, they'll, you know, if they go to a movie, they'll put the ticket stubs in their diary when they're talking about it. It's the same basic idea. You know, if you have a trigger that you have for a specific spell, like a feather or a poppet or something like that, you can put that in the book too. You know?
Mm-hmm.
With a poppet, you can empty it out of the, because a poppet is like a little doll. Think of the Raggedy Ann dolls where it's the circular, or no, gingerbread person, okay?
Yeah.
Except made out of cloth and stuffed with grasses and herbs, okay? And then you do things to the poppet, stitch up a leg for a healing spell, you know, cut a hole where the heart is for somebody that you hate, something like that. Well, there's cases where you have to keep that poppet around. So why not just empty out the herbs and everything that's the stuffing and keep the cloth shell in your Book of Shadows with everything else?
True. And actually, total side note, if you are looking for ideas for things that you can do to your poppet to bless or curse or heal people, Gingerbread Man in the Shrek movies has a lot of those little hints in there. He has stitches,
yeah.
He gets bitten, he deals with all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I loved it when he wound up on the candy cane crutch because his leg was amputated, destroyed.
I liked
I
him in the
later one.
Movies when he had the little, like, icing seams or stitches sewing his legs back.
It was great. It was fantastic. Not my gumdrop buttons.
Or when he's... Okay, now we're going off. But this is how we work. This is how we are. When he's scared and he... what was it he pooped? There was
a couple
kind of candy
chips.
That... Because, I remember him just like, oh... crap. And then just like dropping candy out of his ass. It's like hilarious.
I died.
Okay.
I love that one. Alright.
If you've been listening to Tarot Talk, you know how our conversations go. It's part of the fun of being us.
This is fun. This is nice. So scrapbooking. The idea that I had was to, one of the things that a lot of people, some of the reasons that writing your own Book of Shadows by hand, not only the forcing to read the rituals once, okay, whenever you do something physically that is taking time and effort and concentration, you are investing yourself into it in a magical sense, okay? So when you sit down and you write out the ritual in your Book of Shadows the first time, you are investing your time, your spiritual energy, your magic, or let's call it mana, into that object, okay, that you're writing on. Not just the ritual, but also into the book that it's being written in, okay? This makes it your book. This connects it to you energetically and magically, and why the loss of a Book of Shadows or anything that you do that like that, such a traumatic experience, is because you've got your own energy into that, and it can be used against you. However, when coming up with a permanent Book of Shadows along those lines, you want to get that magical connection to it, okay? You want to invest yourself into it. So going out and buying store-bought pieces for the scrapbook is wonderful and fantastic, but it would be better if you started with nothing and got the component pieces and assembled it all yourself, okay? One of the things that I wanted to do was create the covers as well and get the parchment paper and make the actual calligraphied pages for the rituals and stuff so that I could pass it on to my daughter, she could pass it on to hers, and so forth down the line. And I got some advice from a bookmaker, not a bookie, but somebody that actually makes books like this for a living, and she makes really, really beautiful ones. And some of the advice was really good. Paneling, like you would get for putting up in a room, aside from wallpaper, is wood that's thin enough that it's not going to be that heavy, but it's stiff enough that it's not going to fall apart in a couple of years. And you can manipulate a lot of things on it. You can put cloth on it and glue it down. You can put leather on it and glue that down. You can, if you wanted to, get a slab of wood, get yourself to carve out things on the cover and glue that to it. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Actually, YouTube has tons of videos about making books like that with, like, MDF, fiberboard, like, heavy cardboard, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean,
if
that's... The
wood paneling was... Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking that if that's something that you want to do, and it's actually something I've considered for, like, herbs... because I've got this, you know, idea in my head of being able to flip through a heavy tome of herbs, you know, with like dried samples of different things stuck on the pages kind of deal. But YouTube is a really great resource for that sort of instructional video or different ideas. Because, I mean, everyone who's attempted to do that has, you know, an opinion on how they enjoyed doing it, or, you know, how they might have liked to do it better.
So, yeah, finding stuff like that. Scrapbooking resources are probably the best that you're going to have because that's essentially what you're doing is you're making a scrapbook. It's just a magical scrapbook. And then once again, you know, deciding how it's going to be organized inside. There were a couple of other hints that I was given. One was if you're going to use paper for it, that's fantastic, but make sure it's non-acid paper because acid paper rots really fast. The page that you have now in your handwritten Book of Shadows is probably not going to be there 30 years from now because of the acid that they use to produce the paper. You can take steps to make it last longer. Non-acid paper tends to last a lot longer. Rag fiber content paper lasts even longer than that. That's why money is around so much, because that's rag fiber. Or at least American money is. I don't know about Canadian money, but they make it mostly out of rag fiber, and it stays around forever. 200-300 years is normal.
Our money's plastic now, so. It actually
is
sheets of plastic. It's really cool.
they were coming out with somebody designed new American money, and it was all different lengths and all different colors, so that the larger bills were actually physically larger than the smaller bills. So a $1 bill was the shortest. And a $100 bill was actually like twice its length or something. It was really cool. But anyway, so non-acid paper would be good, something to think about. And think about what you need to do to have it here 200 years from now, okay? A lot of the books that we have now that are real antiques, that are from the Middle Ages, were worked on extensively. They had materials that would endure and would stay around. If you're trying to make an heirloom, then doing it do it right. Okay, don't make it out of the disposable materials that we have now that are going to be gone in 50 years or so. Make it for the centuries. And like I said, you know, you can do it a couple of different ways. You can put rings inside of it for a three-ring binder type thing. You can use cotter pins. Not cotter pins. What am I saying? It's a special type of screw that will attach it all together so that you can move the stuff around. If you want to go out and spend $500 or $1,000 on the huge... charmed Book of Shadows type thing, yeah. But remember also, you know, this is something for you to really invest yourself in. And if you're going to use this as the reference work for everything else, you want to make it up and make it beautiful and make it long-lasting and make it very much a part of you, okay? That's part of the process. It's part of the reason that you're doing this is to put all of the energy and the magic into it, okay? If you're not doing that, then something's wrong.
Mm.
You can also, you know, include pictures of that, you know, speak to you. I know I found several pictures in various places that were absolutely fantastic, that I loved, that I use as goddess and god representations. And I included those in our Book of Shadows, and that's still there, okay? When you're talking about passing something down, yes, you can pass down the entire accumulated group of knowledge to other generations, but if you're going to have only one book survive time, this is the one that you want to have do that, okay? Now, this isn't going to be your daily working journal. That's going to be, like I said, something different, and that's going to be your metaphysical diary. And that's where you put all the things that you're thinking of, that you learn, that you can, your UPG. Hang on just a second. I got to talk to Mary for a moment.
Okay. I guess I should explain the term UPG. In a lot of neo-pagan circles, it's probably come up because of Isaac Bonowitz, but UPG is unverified personal gnosis, and it usually refers to the idea of once you've established like a relationship with a particular deity,
they'll start telling you things.
Well, yes, exactly. You'll start developing certain insights about things they want to, I don't know, receive as offerings, or things that they're particularly interested in, or that, you know, they seem to connect to. Like, there's not really any specific deities in the Norse pantheon, for instance, that are connected to honey, but some UPGs that I've heard connect Air, the healing goddess, to honey because of the use of honey as a healing implement, because of its antibacterial properties, etc. So, you know, that would be an example of a UPG. There's
well,
others
also
where...
Also part of
ahead.
Sorry, is... that it is unverified. You can't find references anywhere other than what you were told and what's in your brain saying that this is what it is.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, that as you get more familiar with your particular deities in the course of time, and actually that's something we're going to be talking about in the next few shows at least, is different pantheons. But as you get better acquainted with a particular deity or, you know, collection of deities, then you're going to find that particular deities that you're using or relating to want certain things from you that, you know, you're never going to find a reference in one of their myths or something like that because, say... I don't know, say you're working with Aphrodite, for instance, and she tells you in the course of your meditations or something that she would really love, like, I don't know, say a strawberry sundae, you know, or, you know, she wants you to have a strawberry sundae every Valentine's Day because that'll, you know, bring love into your life. You know, you're never going to find any reference in Greek mythology to a strawberry sundae. So that would be another example of an unverified personal message.
Well, one example of UPG that I had with Rhiannon the deity, goddess of the birds, Welsh mythology, I was thinking about her, and you really got to... She told me that one of the aspects of her is as a deity of perseverance and tolerance. And if you look at her myths, it really fits well with her. But then there was another thing that in the course of her mythology, she gets punished very severely for a crime that she didn't commit. She winds up having to be a pony to carry people from the front gate to the castle on her back for 7 years as part of her punishment. And she actually told me at one point that there were times that she really enjoyed that, as in bondage pony play. And I was like, okay, well. That's, you know, another example of UPG. For me, that's incorporated into her worship, and, you know, that's another aspect of her personality, but you're never going to find that in the mythology, and it's very, very unlikely that any other people who follow her are going to feel the same thing. But that's something that you want to add into a metaphysical journal like that. And probably incorporate into your Book of Shadows or whatever you call it. So,
exactly. So we have a chatter in the room with us, Kenji. At least that's how I'm pronouncing it, just because of the way it's spelled. But do you have any particular questions that you want us to address tonight, or are you just chilling and enjoying the show?
No, not as of yet, but I know I'm on my path. Well, that's cool. I mean, I'm hoping that this series would help people like him. And I hope that, you know, we going into more detail on these particular topics. I mean, that's what this is. Oh, her. I'm sorry, Ken.
Her name's Sandra, sorry.
Oh, okay, no problem. Her. I'm hoping that this is, you know, what the ultimate goal of this series is going to be. And instead of splitting it into specific pathways, instead of splitting it into specific rituals or, you know, specific ways
traditions
of thought.
Traditions or whatever.
Yeah, we're going to try to keep it global. And it's not just going to be the... pagan paths either. You know, we're going to pull in examples from mainstream Big Five when we can. Probably.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think that would be a really cool idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's not... I can't speak for authority on Judaism or Islam or Hindu beliefs. But I know of some aspects, and if there's an example in one of those, then, you know, I'm going to pull it in and use it as an example.
Yeah, for sure.
Like we did tonight, you know, with the Torah and the Talmud from Judaism, you know, because that's a perfect example of another faith path doing the exact same thing that we're doing. And that's a book of rituals and a book of commentaries, laws, thoughts, and everything else that is still relevant to the religion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, anyway. Trying to think of anything we didn't cover tonight with ritual books and organization. And I find, personally, for me, I find that it's very important to be able to move the rituals and the pages around. Not so much so in the journal part, because in the journal part, you actually want to have a progression from where you start out at to where you wind up at later. But for the rituals, at least, you need to have a way of moving the rituals together so that they are in a progression when you're doing the ritual. Like I said, I was at a ceremony with one high priestess who had, you know, the pages taken out of her Book of Shadows and were reading them by the light of tea lights, and they were in page protectors, and that was great until the part where she accidentally set it on fire.
Oops.
And yeah, that was kind of interesting. And the ritual's still going on, and she's putting out the fire on the pages. It was kind of funny.
Oh, awkward.
talk about invoking the gods. Anyway, so I find that it's important to be able to, you know, take the book with you out there. Oh, one other thing that you could do. If you're feeling really handicrafty, you can do your ritual books in what's called a catalog rack. I don't know if you've seen these, but if you've ever been to a sewing store, you probably have. What it is it's the three-ring binder part of a notebook that clamps around hold pages for that you're sent, so that it's held in this clamp, essentially. And then this clamp is hung on a backing that has rigid metal front and back covers, okay? And this is called a reference rack. It's done this way so that you can have pages that are loose and put them into this and have 6,000 pages, literally, in this reference rack that you can flip through. And it's held open to the page you're looking at. It doesn't try to close. It's not going to fall down. And it's set on an angle so that it's easier to read. Okay? And it's done this way so that people who are in libraries or who do catalog sales or do things like that can easily find information and page through it. And it's usually indexed. I had actually gotten it because I had an idea several years ago of cutting the bindings off of all of my old D&D books and hole-punching the edges and putting them in something like this for a gaming store so that you had a freestanding reference library right there. Because if you've ever been in a gaming store and played D&D with six other people, and had the GM come up with some pronouncement that they disagreed with, immediately everybody goes to their books and starts flipping through pages. Well, this would be a way for the GM to have all the books right there in front of him and be able to turn to whatever reference he needed right then. I tried doing this at one point with the Key of Solomon, the Greater Key and the Lesser Key, the Book of Abra Merlin, the Gardner Book of Shadows, the Alexandrian Book of Shadows, my Book of Shadows, several other ritual books like that, because I was going to give a class on magic at one convention or another. And it wound up not going through, so I still have the reference rack. But you can put your pages into that, too, if you want. You know, also you have the lecterns that you can have in the rooms with your altar and everything. And if you're going to do the classic, you know, demon summoning with the circle out in front of you and you're standing out behind it with your lectern and your magical book open on it and you're reading and pronouncing and waving things. You know, if you want to do something like that, you can. It'd be something good to freak a pizza delivery man out with.
Oh, yes.
Oh, man. There was actually a YouTube video. Some guys got together and did the spooky music and the candelabra and the robes and the masks, and then they ordered pizza. And just filmed how the pizza driver was reacting to it. It's hilarious. But I actually thought about doing that at one time. You know, and you can get the lectern if you want. I'm sure there's several places that you could probably go to get them. I know office supply stores have them. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that a church that's closing down would be willing to sell you part of their church so that it's still used. The point that I'm trying to make here is that if you're going to do the loose leaf pages in your Book of Shadows, make sure that you've got the ability to take the book with you too, because having the ritual that you hand wrote, spent hours, you know, calligraphying and decorating and everything go up in flames because you accidentally held the page a little too close to the candle is not a good thing. Plus, if it's flat and the candle is up higher, then the candlelight will shine down on it rather than you having to hold the page close to the flame to see it. Let's see. I'm trying to think of anything else. And I think I pretty much covered everything, unless there's something that you want to mention, Brian.
Nothing I can really think of right now. But maybe what we'll try to do is, starting from, say, next week, since I don't know how things are, like, I don't know what the listener population is like tonight, but maybe starting next week, we can open the floor for the last half hour of the show to calls and questions to sort of, you know, allow people to interact with us and, you know,
mm-hmm.
give us, you know, something to expand on or, you know, touch on that we may not get to in the course of a normal show.
Yeah.
'Cause I think, I don't know, I mean, I think by this time of night, because of the nature of the show that we're doing now, you know, we've filled the 2 hours so far with what we used to fill, you know, the last half of the show for Tarot Talk with, with, like, banter. And I guess in this series, what I kind of want to do is open the floor to the opportunity for listeners to call in, you know, and ask questions or bring up topics that we may not have thought to touch on. Because, I don't know, I guess that makes for a better show, at least in my opinion.
I would think that it would, you know, and Brian and I, you know, are not, we have a lot of experience, but we're not going to think of everything. I mean, we've covered a lot of stuff on how to go through and make your own Book of Shadows and what it should consist of and everything. But I know that there are a lot of basic problems out there that somebody is going to have a question about at some point. And, you know, it's important to be able to cover that, and because somebody else might be thinking the same thing. In the chat, I just dropped a list of topics that I think we could cover. Next week, I know we're going to be going over deities. And these are not specific deities. These are more classes of deities and groups of deities. We will talk some on the different pantheons, but understand there are literally five deities for every day of the year. And it just depends on how much you want to dig to figure out which deity goes where, what they're doing, and things like that. So it's probably going to be a two-show topic. And
yeah, for sure.
I know after that, Brian and I were talking about doing a three-show or however many shows it winds up taking on tools. And these are the standard paganism tools of the sword, the athame, the wand, the staff, the you know, the censer and the thurible and the candles and everything like that. And so, you know, that's going to be a heck of a big set of topics. And once again, it's going to be, you know, low-cost alternatives. It's going to be how to make your own. It's going to be, you know, places you can acquire them, and also more than that, what they mean. I know a lot of new pagans, at least new to Gardnerian Wicca or Gardnerian flavor, are like, well, why do I need two knives? Because there's the black, there's the athame, and then there's the white-handled knife. And they're two different things, and you can't get them mixed up. And they're always like, well, why do I need two of them? Well, there's a very good reason why you need two of them. And that's one of the things that we can talk about in that show, at least.
And I think we may want to touch on things like the stang, which is, I mean, it's not a common tool, but it's part of certain traditions. And the scourge, and, you know, various things like that that are, you know, people may have heard of or seen reference to in books that are kind of exotic. And, you know,
if you're not... uses a spear.
That I've seen done in numerous traditions, and it's kind of appealing to me, but I don't have a group, so I'm not going to be doing that anytime soon.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very big theatrical tool that I'm like, I'm drawn to, but not without a group of other people to help split the cost or, you know, have any reason to be involved with, you know, wielding a spear in ritual. I mean,
yeah,
I like
and
the
that's when it, well, my tradition of Druidism had that as one of the magical tools, and each Druid was supposed to have their own set. The four traditional treasures of the Tuatha De Dananda, and the sword, the spear, the cauldron, and the stone, which represents the sword of Nuada, the spear of Lu, the cauldron of Plenty, and the Well of Souls. That was basically the same thing, and then the stone of Scone. And you were supposed to have all four of those for your rituals. Well, I never really got a spear, but I had a big staff that was sharpened on the end, which was good enough.
Well, exactly. And I think, actually, I've had people asking me, you know, as a druid, do you have a staff? And I, you know, earlier on, I don't know, probably late last year, I answered no because I don't see the point of having one, but, you know, things have changed, and I've kind of, you know, got a new opinion of it. And I kind of
do.
Well, I mean, I've had staves in the past, but they're not, like, because I don't tend to use them in ritual, I just find them, you know, a little bit large for, you know, solitary rituals in the living room kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, I guess I'll start explaining that when we get to that, you know, discussion of tool, like staves and wands and that sort of thing, because I think it'll be very pertinent then, and I don't want to, you know,
don't wanna
get rid
it
of
all
that.
Away, yeah.
Exactly. I don't want to use it up before we get there. And, you know, I've gone through numerous chalices, you know, and cups for my rituals. You know, I once had a nice pottery, you know, cup, and it smashed. And
oh God, yes, we did say swords. The sword is a standard tool of Gardnerian flavored Wicca. I don't know how much use it gets in other traditions of Wicca, and it is another tool that was used in my tradition of Druidism, at least, the ODU.
Yeah.
You would think that the swords would not be that prevalent in Druidism, but it is because they are magical treasures. And they do represent, at least in our tradition, the sword represented conflict, and therefore was always in the north where, I can't think of the region in the north.
Oh, God.
Ah,
let me try to think of it.
The six counties are up there, and it's the four divisions of Ireland, and...
You know what? I might have to talk to another a host of a pagan show I used to listen to all the time. He's a druid of his own order, who actually knows a ton about Ireland and that sort of thing. And I might see if he won't, you know, kind of come in on the show and we, you know, do a night about druidism.
Right, yeah. I'm embarrassed because I used to teach this stuff. And I know it's like Lancaster, I think. Let's see.
Lancaster
to find it.
Sound Irish, though. Leinster?
Leinster, Munster. No, it's the Wheel of the Year. I think it's Leinster. Let's see. Buddhism, Child's Book, Druidic Studies. There it is. All right, so where is my map of Ireland? Come on, Birch, Bridget's Cross, Britain map. There it is. Ulster. That's what I was talking about.
Ulster. Oh,
yeah. Because yeah, Ulster is always the area of Ireland that is constantly fighting. Leinster, which is on the west coast, or the east coast, tends to be more concerned with trade and taking care of crafting things. And so that's where the spear would go. Munster is in the southern area, and that was where a lot of kings came from. It was very peaceful and extremely prosperous. The stone would go down there, and Connaught, and I know I'm mispronouncing that, is on the east coast, and that's where the cauldron would go. And that's how we arranged those in my druidic order. And then we had the seat of power in the center on the hill. And that, you know, it made sense at the time, and it still does. But, yeah, so...
It depends on the cosmology, because I'm like...
Yeah, it's associations. And when you're dealing with magical things, the associations, how you're associating them, how you're seeing them work together is what's important.
Yeah,
because,
for sure.
You know, when... It may not make much sense to have a sword when you also have an athame and when you also have a wand, when all of them do essentially the same action. They direct energy from one point to another. Okay, but there is a reason for having three different tools. Okay, the sword is the athame for the group. The athame is the personal ritual dagger for each witch, and it is supposed to be used. It's not supposed to be just sitting on a table someplace looking pretty. It is supposed to actually cut things. The wand is used for energy direction, but more than that, it is where you have the sharp and the metal and the iron of earth and male and fire encompassed in the athame. You have the wood and the yielding principle of the female in the wand. So even though they do the same thing, and even though they are interchangeable to a point, if you have an association of feminine with the wand and masculine with the athame, you need both because you need both of those elements at times in the magical ritual.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we'll probably touch on the Great Rite at some point in I don't know, in a discussion of sacred sexuality or something down the line.
Oh, God, yes.
I have no idea what we're going to discuss.
No, it's really up in the air. It's one of those things where there's a lot of people who will see something, and once you're in the practice and you've been doing it for a while, it's so obvious why they're there. But for the new person, somebody just getting started, it's like, why do you have a ritual celebrating sex in a magical religious rite?
Why not?
Well, there's that, but the basic answer is this is a faith path dealing with sacred dichotomy of male and female. Why wouldn't you?
Well, and I think, too, that the dichotomy between male and female and the balance between them is an essential part of numerous religions, but what tends to be understood is that there's a very surface level interpretation of the religion. So you're dealing with like Christianity that has a particular format and understanding of sex. You know, they use the concept of chastity in a certain light, but then you get into the mystical Gnostic traditions of Christianity that talk about chastity in an entirely different way, in the sense of, you know, a more like in the sense of a proper kind of relationship rather than a frivolous use of sex for, you know, pleasure alone kind of thing. And then get into like alchemy and Kabbalah, which talk about the transmutation of energy. And, you know, I mean, sex is a
Tantra.
Pivotal part of each of those traditions, etc. Oh, and of course, Tantra. I mean, this is stuff you open the door and, you know, you find yourself in a hallway of doors. So, I mean, we'll probably deal with this when we talk, you know, sacred sexuality, because I'm sure we could go on forever about it, you know, because one thing will lead to another and it'll just go on forever. But,
and so
yeah,
then
I
we,
mean,
you know,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Brian.
Well, because I was thinking, like, the balance between and the interplay between what are considered opposite polarities it's not even an issue. It's not even a matter of that binary of the, quote, opposites when you really get into an understanding of those kind of principles. Just like light and dark do not exist, you know, they're not like separate concepts. They can't exist without one of, you know, one or the other. Because
and
darkness is
thing.
An absence of light, etc.
And then we're also, it's not going to be just topics. There's going to be a couple of nights, I'm sure, where we just start talking and we're just going to riff. And one of the things that, you know, we could riff for hours on is the fact that a lot of the mainstream religions are seen as binary, and most of the pagan religions are seen as poly whatever. Because you've got, you know, a black and white concept in most of the mainstream religions, and if you're not one, then you're the other. Whereas most of the pagan religions that I know of, at least, have this spectrum. And, you know, just to bring one example into it, the Buddhist concepts and Shinto concepts of black, white, and gray. Because if you look at most of those sacred symbols, it's not one or two, it's 3, 4, 5, 12, 20, 100, 1,000, you know, with the lotus blossoms and things like that. So you've got arrays of stuff. And I know that one of the biggest symbols in Druidism is the triskel, which is 1, 2, 3, and it's not off-on. It's also, you know, kind of in the middle there, where it's combining the two.
Well, in Kabbalah, the concept of that three is positive, negative, and neutral, because, you know, the positive and negative are considered opposite, and if you ignore the fact that they neutralize each other, then, you know, there can be this idea that there's only three or two, but, you know, that's where you've got like father, mother, you know, child kind of thing. And that three becomes a very significant concept in multiple spiritual traditions.
And that's, you know, something else that we're going to be talking about and riffing on. So we're not just going to, Yes, tonight we're going to be talking about threes. Tonight we're just going to be talking. If this comes up, we're going to be talking about this.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, for those of you who've listened to Tarot Talk, you know Joy and I can go on for countless hours about all sorts of stuff that, you know, just doesn't seem like it relates, but there's always some tangent and thread that, you know, ties it together, and it's like, wow, that's fascinating, crazy stuff.
And that's why we're doing this series. We're doing it to try to give you guys, the listeners, these tools and these associations that we've come to through 20 years, 30 years of practice, and let you kind of have a shortcut on it. Because here's the problem as I'm seeing it in general, in the pagan community. We have a lot of people who are restating the same thing over and over and over. We have no original work taking it all forward. Okay, 30 years ago, or 60 years ago with Gardner, we had this revolutionary concept that you could have a faith path that had nothing to do with Judeo-Christianity. Then you had, 30 years ago, this revolutionary idea that you could have a faith path that actually was a living, breathing organism that was just as spiritual and just as rich and deep as Christianity. Then 20 years ago, you had this explosion of information explaining all of these basic concepts, not only to people who are already practicing it, but to new people coming into it and looking for an alternative. And it had this radical notion that women were equal called feminism. And that, you know, got incorporated into all of it. Well, here we are, 2013, and we've had no radical steps forward since then. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because everybody is catching up and everybody is trying to work with the same basic information, and they're all restating that same information over and over and over again in different ways. What I would like to do with this is to go, okay, you've got all of this basic information. Here it is. We're going to touch on it just enough so that you know you have a context for what we're talking about, but now it's time to talk about the advanced stuff that somebody who has multiple years of practice behind them understands and knows. And now that you know this, you can take what we've experienced and go forward from there. Mm-hmm. Where are you going to go? We don't know. But it's our hope that you will build on that and move it forward. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left, so if you have questions, if you have ideas, we are, you know, available. Send me an email, joy.a.philip@gmail.com. And I'm on Twitter at Joy Philip. I'm on Tumblr as wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com. Brian, go with yours.
You can email me at woodwost.radio@yahoo.ca. And you can hit me up on Tumblr at cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com, or hit the show's Facebook page, Woodwost Radio. Should be pretty easy to find. I don't know, because I don't ever search for it. And the show has a blog, too. I'm kind of slack on doing anything with that, but it's woodwost-radio.tumblr.com. And feel free to hit me up with any questions, comments. If you liked the intro music, I want to know, because I'm sort of thinking about a few other pieces that I could try as well. But if you really like the one that we have, tell me so that I can be, like, happy about it or not.
and, yeah. People.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping this series is going to be really fascinating for you guys as well as us. But we do hope for your interactions, because that will help us a great deal. That's all I can think of to say. You know, good
pretty
night,
much.
Folks.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening.
We hope that this becomes a very regular thing. Talk to y'all later.
night, folks. Thank you for joining us.